I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. Our show has featured numerous stories about displaced people. It's a topic, naturally, of ongoing relevance, given all the forces that turn people into refugees from various causes, political strife to natural disaster. I guess my world is actually much too small, because until today, I was unaware of the history of Jews taking refuge in Shanghai, in China. Today, we get to hear an account of how thousands of European Jews found a home there in the 1930s. But there's a truly cosmopolitan twist to this, because we're going to start the tale far away from Shanghai, in Baghdad, actually. With us now to paint the scene and introduce the main characters for this story is Jonathan Kaufman, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who has written and reported on China for decades, for the Boston Globe, later for the Wall Street Journal, actually, for which he was the China bureau chief from 2002 to 2005. Jonathan Kaufman is director of the School of Journalism at Northeastern University in Boston, and he is author of The Last Kings of Shanghai, The Rival Jewish Dynasties That Helped Create Modern China. Jonathan, welcome to our show.
Thanks very much. I'm glad to be with you.
Okay, I'm ignorant of a lot of things, and we always learn something new, and who knows where the gaps are, but am I alone in not having heard of Jewish refugees in the early 20th century to China?
I think it is an unknown story to most people, including to most Jews. When we think about sort of Jews through history, we all know the Fiddler on the Roof story. Jews who were started in Russia or Eastern Europe in ghettos, they were poor, and then gradually moved up through society, came to America, and so forth. But the Jews I'm writing about, we read about in the Bible. These are Jews who were kidnapped from Jerusalem after the destruction of the temple. And in the Bible, where we read about, by the waters of Babylon, we wept when we remembered Zion. These are Jews who went to Baghdad. Babylon is Baghdad. And these Jews in Jerusalem 2,000 years ago were kidnapped from their homes, brought to Baghdad. But there they ended up flourishing. They became very influential merchants. They were so prosperous and so well known that the rulers of Baghdad, the Turkish rulers, the Ottomans over the years, would often turn to them for advice. And they would take the leading family and treat them almost like the secretary of the treasury, helping them collect taxes, helping them plot how to keep the economy stable. And whenever these Jews were to visit the Pasha in his temple back in the 16th and 17th century, he'd be carried on a sedan chair, and people in the street would tip their heads in reverence because Jews had reached such a powerful and influential position in Baghdad.
So you're telling me that there has been, with continuity over more than two millennia, a Jewish population in Baghdad?
Exactly. Now, what happens in the early 19th century, like in many countries, the politics turns against the Jews. And even though Jews are very wealthy and powerful, they begin to be kidnapped for ransom. The government is turning against them. And so the family I write about, the Sassoon family, which is the most prominent family in Baghdad, one of the richest families, they're getting very nervous. And David Sassoon, who is 37 years old, about to become head of this very powerful family, is kidnapped and held in jail for ransom in Baghdad. His father runs to the jail, bails his son out, and takes him right to the waterfront, where he puts him on a boat to ship him out of Baghdad and to safety, leaving behind his family. And before David Sassoon is put in this boat, his father covers his shoulders with a cloak. And inside the cloak are sewed all sorts of precious gems and minerals so he can get his start in the new world. So it's at that point that the Sassoons are essentially expelled from Baghdad, make their way to India, and then eventually to China.
The time frame for this again?
This is in the early 1800s, starting about 1820, 1830. And then the Jews end up in Shanghai in the 1840s because in India they encounter the British Empire. The British Empire is expanding, and the British need businessmen of whatever background is out there to help them, you know, expand markets throughout Asia. The Sassoons get involved in the opium trade and in other kinds of trading. And when the British go to war with China to open up all the Chinese ports, China's essentially closed off to the West for centuries. The British want to sell goods there. Their merchants want to be successful. And so the British go to war, what's called the Opium Wars. And when they open all these ports, the Sassoons, very entrepreneurial businessmen, decide to follow the Union Jack. They become loyal British citizens and then reap all the commercial benefits of being involved in the opium trade and other kinds of businesses.
So even before we get to the era of the Nazis, the Sassoon family has established itself as merchants in Shanghai?
They have, and even more than merchants. I mean, you know, right now as COVID, we're all talking about the trips we want to make and all the places we want to go to. Well, if this were the 1920s or 1930s, we would all be talking about going to Shanghai. Shanghai in the 1920s and 1930s was one of the largest cities in the world, one of the most exotic cities in the world. It was a place that people wanted to visit because it had this kind of hint of danger. It was a very different culture. And this was possible because the Sassoon family expanded from the opium trade and from their other trading businesses. And Victor Sassoon, who was the leader of the family at that point, built an extravagant hotel right on the Bund, the waterfront in Shanghai. And Charlie Chaplin would sail there to visit him. Noel Coward was in the hotel writing Private Lives. Wallace Simpson, who will make the King of England leave his throne, was photographed in Shanghai, nude, except she was wearing a life jacket. So the word got around that if you were wealthy, if you were a celebrity, Shanghai was the place to go. And in a way, the sort of maestros of this cultural explosion were the Sassoon family and another Jewish family from Baghdad, the Kaduris. The Victor Sassoon presided over Shanghai, not just economically, but in terms of parties. He would have these extravagant parties at his hotel, costume balls where people dressed up as circus acts and he was the circus master. They would dress up as school children and he would be the school principal. Everyone wanted to go to these parties. And so the excitement around Shanghai was really being developed and driven by these two families who had their roots in Baghdad 100 years earlier.
This is just astonishing. I think in a matter of less than maybe 3 or 4 minutes, we've gone from weeping by the waters of Babylon, you know, to parties and Charlie Chaplin. You know, it's kind of, well, I don't know. It's not exactly whiplash, but it's fast.
Yeah, it is. And I think one thing that, you know, we tend to forget was that, you know, China in a way was the Silicon Valley of its day. It was a place where you could make a lot of money very quickly. But it was also a place which was colonized and these families were imperialists. You know, I think we often think of Jews and their role in social justice and they're often liberal and so forth. And in many ways, these two families were probably better about some of those issues than some of their British rivals. But they were imperialists and they enjoyed kind of living the imperial life that you could live in the British colonies. But at the same time, because they were Jewish, they were also treated as outsiders. So, for example, in addition to Shanghai, the Sassoons, there were 8 sons in the original family. And their father sent them to England saying, you know, England is going to be the future and the British Empire is so powerful. And so he would encourage his sons to move to England, to buy country houses, to send their children to Oxford, Cambridge, and Eton and so forth. And yet, despite all that, when you read the way in which the British looked at the Sassoons, they always treated them as outsiders. There was a lot of social anti-Semitism in Shanghai as well as in London, not coming from the Chinese, but really coming from the British. And so when you go through, I had access to a lot of documents, and you'll read about these British aristocrats going to these fabulous parties. And yet when they go home, they write letters to their friends saying, oh, these Jews are kind of striving or they're hooked noses, and I wouldn't really want to associate with them. So I think for the Sassoons, it was sort of double-edged. They were accepted at one level in society. They became incredibly wealthy. They were probably the 6th wealthiest family in the world by the 1920s or or 1930s, but the British still looked at them as outsiders and were still suspicious of them, even when they were friends with the king or the Prince of Wales and visiting Buckingham Palace.
Now, Victor Sassoon has an interesting event in his life, World War I, I believe, has injuries sustained during an airplane crash.
Right. Victor Sassoon grows up in London. He grows up a playboy, basically. He is always seen with a chorus girl on either arm. He has one of the best wine cellars in London, even when he's a college student. But during World War I, he's injured in a plane crash, and he falls into a depression. And he basically feels that because of his disability, he won't be able to enjoy the great social life that he was enjoying up to that point. And so he decides to go out to India and China, where the Sassoons have all their business interests, and kind of try his hand at that. And he turns out to be a brilliant businessman. And he decides to move all of the Sassoon wealth to Shanghai and builds this hotel. He buys factories. He basically helps develop Shanghai into a modern city. And at the same time, he does the parties and he begins to collect horses and he begins to have affairs with all sorts of women as they pass through Shanghai. It was funny, at one point when I was doing my research, I was in Shanghai. I was visiting the Cathay Hotel, which was the hotel that Victor Sassoon built. And he had built himself a penthouse on the top floor where he could entertain people and then look out from his windows onto his Shanghai empire.
I want to talk a little bit about the women in the family, too, because even before we get to the 1930s, there are some fairly impressive women from both of these tribes, from families.
Yeah, no, that's true. And I think often the story of women, especially when you're reaching back into the, you know, 1800s, the early 20th century, is really obscured. In the Sassoon family, as I mentioned, there were eight sons who were building the dynasty. But they began to move to London, and they were living the high life in London, and they were kind of losing interest in the business because they were having so much fun at their parties and entertaining the British aristocracy. And at one point, the youngest son, who was in charge of a lot of the Asia business operations, died unexpectedly, and it was kind of a crisis for the family. But his wife, a woman named Flora Sassoon, stepped forward and said she could run the business almost as a regent for a few years until their son, who at the time was just a teenager, kind of came of age and could take things over. So her brothers-in-law in London thought that was a great idea. You know, she was just a woman. She would be a caretaker. They would still be running things. But as it turned out, Flora Sassoon was a brilliant woman. She spoke several languages and was very astute when it came to business. And now this was at a time when not only women couldn't vote, women in India lived behind what was called purdah, and that meant they couldn't be seen in public. So Flora Sassoon begins running this vast business empire from her living room. But she begins to break the rules. She begins to show up at the office. She begins to tour factories. She's seen out in public. But she also develops a real sense of caring for the workers. And at one point, sort of similar to today, a plague breaks out in Bombay, where the Sassoon businesses are headquartered. And it's a bubonic plague. And workers are terrified to go to work because they're afraid they're going to catch it. And so Flora Sassoon gets in touch with scientists in Europe and brings them over to Bombay to search for a cure to develop a vaccine, which they do. And then Flora Sassoon insists on getting the vaccine, and not only that, but having a photograph taken of her with her bare arm as she's injected with the vaccine so that all her Indian workers will know that it's safe, that the white woman, the British aristocrat who controls all this wealth, trusts this vaccine. And so as a result, the workers do get the vaccine. And in many ways, Flora kind of saves the family enterprise. But in London, her brother and her brothers-in-law are getting nervous. They see that she's very powerful. She has a lot of loyalty among the workers, and they don't like that. And so her brothers-in-law essentially stage a boardroom coup. They oust her from the business and then seize control back. And Flora goes on. She sails to London. She becomes fairly well-known philanthropist and scholar, but she never sets foot in the Sassoon businesses again. As a friend of mine said to me, you know, she's kind of hit the bamboo ceiling where her own family didn't want her to succeed.
And another woman, not from the Sassoon, but from the Kadoorie side, Laura Kadoorie, quite a story there.
Yeah, she's really another remarkable woman. Ellie Kadoorie, who was the patriarch of the Kadoorie family, goes from Baghdad, works for the Sassoons for a while, breaks off on his own, and by 1890 or so has become a millionaire in China. And so at that point, he does what a lot of men do, is he decides to find a wife. And so he sails to London and meets Laura, who is a daughter of a fairly prosperous British Jewish family. They fall in love, they get married. And at that point, typically what would happen is that Laura would get pregnant and Ellie would sail back to China on his own and continue all his business dealings. But Laura was very independent-spirited. She was actually older than Ellie. Her family was a little worried that she might be a spinster. She enjoyed traveling. And she announces after their marriage that I'm going to go with you to China. You're not going to just leave me here in London. I'm going to go with you. And so the two of them sail to Hong Kong. They quickly have two small boys. And then Laura announces that she wants to accompany Ellie as he travels through China. And even more remarkably for my purposes, she keeps a diary during that time. And it's really an extraordinary document. It's like reading about Katharine Hepburn in in a movie or something. She, while her husband is off doing business deals, she's traveling throughout China, seeing the civil war, seeing the tremendous poverty in China, traveling admittedly with servants and her two boys, but I think really getting a close-up view of what life in China is really like. And she concludes, and again, this is in like the early 1900s, she concludes that China's problem is that women and girls are not being educated. And so she decides to throw herself into creating schools for Chinese girls. This is something that no one is thinking about at the time. And she persuades her husband to fund these schools, girls, not only in China, but also back in Baghdad, because she's convinced if girls can get an education, they can climb out of poverty, and that they'll be able to sort of achieve more success and more happiness in life. In many ways, she becomes the conscience of the family. Eventually, the family settles in Shanghai in a very grand house. And in around 1920, a fire breaks out in the house. And Laura escapes from the fire. But then she's convinced that the Chinese governess she had hired, the servant she had hired to take care of her boys, is still trapped inside. So she runs back into the house to try to save the Chinese governess. As it turned out, the Chinese governess had gotten out through another door. Laura becomes disoriented. She's overcome by smoke, and she dies in the house fire. Now, this is a tragedy for the Kadoorie family, of course, but even more, it's a story that the Chinese talk about even to today. The idea that a well-born British woman would rush into a burning house to save a Chinese servant is something that, you know, is unimaginable to many Chinese. And I think it's a way in which not only does her spirit live on, but it also, I think for a lot of the Chinese, sets the Kadooris apart, and in many ways sets Jews apart, where the Chinese begin to think, these are not just like the other British, these are not like the other, you know, colonizers and Westerners we're dealing with. There's something that's different about these people and different about the Kadoorie family.
Well, on this theme of compassion and humanitarian outreach in so many different ways, from education to trying to save the governess there, that theme's going to be our bridge to talking about the refugees from Europe and what these families were able to do in support of that remarkable cause. We'll talk about it after a break here as we're visiting with Jonathan Kaufman. He's author of The Last Kings of Shanghai, The Rival Jewish Dynasties That Helped Create Modern China. Stay tuned to Constant Wonder. You're listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. It's a pleasure to have with us Jonathan Kaufman, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. We're talking about his book, The Last Kings of Shanghai, The Rival Jewish Dynasties That Helped Create Modern China. Oh, there's a thesis in there somewhere about creating modern China. I think we're going to get to that. But before we do, Jonathan, these two families, so far we've been focusing sort of on their own fortunes, what the how they established themselves, how they became wealthy and powerful and forces to be reckoned with. But that sets them up to do something really, really grand during the Nazi era.
Yeah, in the 1920s and 1930s, as I had mentioned, Shanghai becomes a place that Charlie Chaplin and so many others want to visit, and they arrive on these big cruise ships from Europe. But starting around 1937, 38, these cruise ships start bringing a different kind of passenger. And these are Jewish refugees who are fleeing the Nazis. By 37, 38, of course, the Nazis have taken control. They invade Austria. And Jews in Europe are in a panic. They desperately want to find a place of refuge and of safety. And as we know, sadly, most countries shut their door. There was no place that was willing to accept the refugees as the Nazis began to spread and as the Holocaust grew closer and closer. Except because Shanghai had been colonized by the British and the Americans and the French, the Japanese had moved in. They all had sort of chunks of Shanghai. There was essentially no functioning government there. And what that meant was that if you were Jewish and a refugee and got to Shanghai, you would be safe. Nobody would turn you aside. And so slowly in 37, and then, you know, in a more accelerating pace after that, thousands of refugees flee Berlin and Vienna, their belongings, they get whatever money they can. They make their way to Italy to board these cruise ships because they've heard of this place called Shanghai that will provide them safety when everywhere else is turning them away. Now, again, you have to imagine what it's like, and there are photographs of this. I mean, these are often middle-class Jews, store owners, musicians, college professors, lawyers. They gather with their families. They're dressed as if they're about to go out for, you know, an evening out in Berlin or Vienna. And after a two-week cruise on a ship or trip on a ship, they show up in Shanghai, which is a hugely crowded city, tremendous poverty, Chinese literally dying in the streets. No one speaks English. No one speaks German. And these refugees are just pouring off these ships, just knowing that at least they're out of the reach of the Nazis for a time. So Victor Sassoon and the Kaduri family, even though they're businessmen, recognize this threat this threat to people, you know, of the same religion as themselves. And so they really begin to try to help these refugees. Victor Sassoon turns many of his office buildings into dormitories where these Jews can find safety. The Kaduri set up a school because there are all these children arriving. They set up a school taught by some of these teachers. So the students, the children have some structure in their life. And even more dramatically, Victor Sassoon uses all his charm and much of his money to try to persuade the Japanese to protect these Jews. The Japanese at this point have invaded China. They've conquered the northern part of China, but it's still before Pearl Harbor. So they've encircled Shanghai. And they've sent some soldiers into Shanghai, but they haven't conquered it because they don't want to draw the United States or Britain into the war. And so Victor Sassoon invites these Japanese officers to eat with him and to drink with him and to, you know, attend his parties and his nightclubs. At the same time, he's having his waiters and waitresses spy on them. And all along the way, he keeps saying to them, look, I'm very wealthy. Maybe I'll invest in some Japanese companies. I'll talk to Churchill, who I'm friendly with, and try to keep him out of the war. I have these friends in Hollywood. I'll have them talk to Roosevelt to keep America out of the war. And at the same time, he's trying to find a place where these Jews could be safe. He flies to South America to try to buy land there. He hires many Jews to work for him. And his real goal is to keep the gates open so more and more refugees can kind of use this escape valve. And ultimately, 18,000 refugees escape Berlin. They escape Vienna and are able to settle in Shanghai. Eventually, the Japanese catch on to what Victor Sassoon is doing. He has to flee the country. But these 18,000 refugees remain protected. And even after Pearl Harbor, when the Nazis show up in Shanghai and they meet with the Japanese and they say to the Japanese, you know, you control Shanghai now. You've got a Jewish problem, all these Jewish refugees. We propose that you gather them all up, put them on barges, and sink the barges in the middle of the river. And that will take care of your Jewish problem. The Japanese are horrified at this, in part because they believe that what Victor Sassoon told them, that these Jews should be protected because Victor Sassoon and others will kind of try to help the Japanese cause. And as a result, in the middle of World War II, with Japan and Germany allies, even after Pearl Harbor, none of these refugees are killed during World War II. They all survived the war in Shanghai. It's one of the miracles of World War II, and it was really made possible by what the Sassoons and the Kadouris did.
And you've called this kind of a Schindler moment, to make the comparison to the Schindler story.
Yeah, I think it is. In many ways, it is like Schindler because, you know, after the war ends, the Kadouris and the Sassoons go back to their old ways, you know, that you know, this is something they rise to the occasion. They do the moral thing. After the war is over, the communists kind of are now advancing on Shanghai. But Victor Sassoon returns. He thinks the parties will continue. And the Kadouris do the same. So there's a way in which they had this great moment of moral clarity, but then they couldn't quite realize that the whole superstructure that they had created in Shanghai was about to come tumbling down, not because of the Nazis, not because of the Japanese, but because of the Chinese communists.
And with the arrival of the communists, does that signal a change for those refugees? It was, did Shanghai just serve as a way station onto the next place?
That's exactly right. I mean, remember, these Jews had gone to Shanghai not because they wanted to go there. It was the one place that would accept them. So the war, they end up dispersing all around the world. Many of them had hoped to go back to Berlin and to Vienna or to Germany and Austria, but of course, those were ravaged landscapes. The Holocaust had wiped out all their relatives and everything they knew. So they settled in Palestine, they settled in the United States, they settled in Australia. The Sassoons and the Kadouris stay on, but eventually, as the communists encircle Shanghai and conquer Shanghai, they eventually flee as well. It's interesting. Victor Sassoon buys a round-trip ticket when he leaves Shanghai, but he never goes back. And he actually becomes fairly bitter. Most of his money is in Shanghai real estate, so he loses all of that. He ends up settling in the Bahamas. And he talks about China almost like a spurned lover. He says, I didn't leave China. China left me. And I don't think Victor could ever accept the fact he would no longer be the kind of, you know, king of Shanghai. The Kadouris are different. The Kadouris decide to go to Hong Kong, which is a British colony. And they are rebuilding their fortune and become richer than ever. They're part of the tremendous effort that Hong Kong makes to become an economic, really a superpower almost. And the Kadouris always keep lines of communication open to China because they believe that China will emerge again as a powerful country. And they, you know, feel great affection for China. So they spend all their time in the 50s and 60s, 70s in Hong Kong. And today, they are the richest Western family in China. They're worth more than $13 billion. They've been invited back to China by the government. They meet regularly with Xi Jinping. And they've been able to sort of maintain their influence and power even through yet another political upheaval.
Yeah, that is a strange relationship, I would have to say, because last I checked, communists really still haven't changed their views on imperialists and capitalists.
Except when they benefit China. I mean, I think that's one of the things that was interesting to me as I worked on the book is that the Chinese, I think, and the communists for sure, have put out this sort of conventional view that, you know, China was a great empire, was colonized by the West, it was treated badly by everyone, the communists came along, and liberated the country, and now China is a world power once again. But I think what that misses is the kind of cosmopolitanism that did exist in places like Shanghai. And so families like the Kadouris and the Sassoons, they were not only making themselves wealthy, they were in a way training generations of Chinese businessmen in globalization, how you trade with the West, you know, how you adapt all this new technology. And in Hong Kong as well, the Kadouris, you know, had many Chinese employees. They did deals with the Chinese. And I think this was a way in which Chinese began to get a glimpse of how the world economy operated and laid the foundation for China's incredible growth and its power today. It's interesting to me, even with all the tensions between the U.S. and China, the Chinese government is going to be publishing my book. They're translating it and publishing it. And I think that's in part a recognition that Chinese history is more complicated and that these foreigners did play an important role in China's growth and that that needs to be acknowledged and understood as the Chinese, you know, begin to rise and become so powerful around the world.
So I guess what I'm hearing you say that, well, in your subtitle where you say that these two families helped create modern China, it's far more than building a hotel or two. It's far more than owning factories. It has to do with importing an economic worldview.
Exactly. You know, I think whoever visits or sees movies about Shanghai or Hong Kong understands that they're different than the rest of China. They are more outward looking. They're more sophisticated. They have a certain pride in their ability to rival New York or Paris or London or Tokyo. And I think there's a real confidence there. And I think one of the tensions in China now, I think, is a tension between, and I think you see this in the United States and across Europe, are the Chinese going to be an outward-looking country that wants to be part of the global economy, that wants to take on responsibilities for issues like climate change and so forth? Or are they going to become an insular, nationalistic country that just looks inward? And I think what the Kadouris and the Sassoons and this period of time and this story represents are the benefits that come from globalization and that come from being outward-looking and having a kind of mixing of cultures. On the other hand, as we know, everywhere there's this other trend about nationalism and only trusting people who look like you. And I think in the same way the United States and parts of Europe are struggling with that, I think that's becoming a debate in China as well.
It's a remarkable story with so much ground that you have covered for us. Jonathan Kaufman, thank you for being with us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Jonathan Kaufman is author of The Last Kings of Shanghai, The Rival Jewish Dynasties That Helped Create Modern China. The fact that Shanghai has long been a cosmopolitan crossroads, that's an idea we've explored many times before here on the show. Shanghai, a fertile seedbed for stories of international intrigue, harrowing escapes, all that sort of thing, seems to be a place caught between East and West, between tyranny and anarchy. Get ready to hear a story of a woman whose family fled from Shanghai after the Communist Revolution, and she only recently persuaded her mother to talk about it, to tell stories that her mother had long kept locked away in silence. I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. Thanks for listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. For 5 decades, our next guest had pressed her mother to learn about her childhood in China and her family's flight from Shanghai in the 1950s. And this story, this backstory of the family's past, it all happened during that chapter of history when the Chinese communists were trying to consolidate power and then succeeded. Well, her mother's story turned out to be far more powerful, painful, and important than she ever could have imagined. Helen Zia is the author of Last Boat Out of Shanghai, the epic story of the Chinese who fled Mao's revolution.
I think it would be fair to say that it hounded me because just like many kids, you know, you at some point, at quite young, you ask your parents, oh, tell me something about, you know, whatever. And because I was a Chinese-American kid growing up in New Jersey at a time when there were very few Asian-Americans of any kind outside of Chinatowns and Japantowns and so forth, I wondered, how did we get here? What was it like for you? And I would ask my mother, Mom, tell me about growing up in China for you. And as you said in your intro, she would reply, that was wartime, bad memory. And that will shut you down. And I think I asked her that many times. And after a while, you just kind of, in your mind, think, well, there's nothing to say, or just give up. And over time, I just stopped asking.
Yeah, and I do want to get to that night when she finally had something to say about it. But first, you do such a good job of explaining why so many, over a million people had to flee.
Yeah.
And it's impossible to tell that story comprehensively, and so you have to do it just representative stories, and your mother's is one of them. What was going on in the late 40s that made the whole place collapse and life come crashing down for these people?
Well, first to say over a million people from Shanghai alone. So this book is about the people who fled Shanghai, which just imagine a New York, London, Paris, Berlin, which is where Shanghai ranked in the world at the time of the 1930s, 1940s. And suddenly, with over a period of World War, so Shanghai was occupied for Shanghai and China, but the city of Shanghai was occupied for 8 years of World War II. Most of us in America think of World War II as starting in December 7th, 1941, but it actually began in 1937 for China, and it began with the Battle of Shanghai. And so that continued for 8 years until 1945, victory over Japan, and the armistice, you know, surrender documents are signed, and there's not a moment of peace in China, because immediately, even before the surrender documents are signed by Japan, a civil war that had been simmering all this time anyway, the civil war breaks out anew. And so you have a population that had already lived through 8 years of terrible, devastating war and occupation, and then slides right into a civil war of Chinese against Chinese. And so this was nationalists who were the old regime that were backed by the U.S. government, for one, and the communists who were backed by the Soviet Union. And so that war continues until toward the end of the 1940s to 1949 was when Chairman Mao and the Communist Party on October 1st, 1949 declared, the Chinese people have stood up. This is now the People's Republic of China. And so that process of heading toward the actual declaration of a new government and a victory for the People's Liberation Army and the Chinese Communist Party, the events leading up to that, the handwriting was on the wall for quite some time. The old regime was falling apart. It could not manage, you know, even from the time that World War II ended till the revolution, a period of 4 years, they had really not just no control, but it was a government that everybody felt was just corrupt beyond belief. They would take relief supplies from the United Nations, from the United States, things that were intended for people who were starving, who had nothing. And they would just, you know, the wealthy and well-connected, including the politicians, would take those supplies and sell them at exorbitant prices and basically profiteer off of the suffering of the Chinese people. And that was pretty well known. People were disgusted, and they couldn't live anymore because they would sell at higher and higher prices. People would go to a shop and look in the window and try to figure out, can I afford to buy a pair of shoes for my child? And they would watch as a hand would reach in the window and put a new price, and a few minutes later, a new price, and a new price. I mean, you know, they had a saying that, 1940, 100 yuan would buy a pig. You know, a couple years later, it would buy a chicken. A few years later, it would buy an egg. And, by the end of World War II and as the, you know, period of the Civil War happened, it wouldn't even buy a book of matches. And so people were seeing not just, you know, a country and an economy collapse, but it was getting increasingly difficult for people just to live and figure out how they would, you know, get the next meal. And so Shanghai was, you know, the most sophisticated, the most advanced, the most technological, the most industrialized, and the most Western city of China. It, you know, had, depending on what period you're looking at, between 4 to 6 million people. By the time of the revolution, it had 6 million people. And it was second only to New York, really, in population worldwide for a major global city. And so that was just a, you know, we could say a 12-year or more than 12-year period where people had experienced terrible, terrible war, inability to live, inability to foresee that your children could live and survive to adulthood. And so during that time, people began, you know, had many different survival strategies, exit strategies, and as it became clear that the old nationalist regime of Chiang Kai-shek was not going to be able to govern, they began to realize that the communist revolution was inevitable and then had to decide what they were going to do about it. And many decided with their feet and figured, well, we don't know what's going to come. And you could say a lot of people left not because they knew what communism was or what life would be like, but just out of fear of the unknown. Then you know that something is coming, that all of the propaganda, all of the information we had ever heard said that this was a terrible thing that was coming. And you're not sure, but you have to decide, do I leave the community, the work, the everything we have ever accumulated in life, our families, and pick up and leave and go where? And so that was the setting for the period, I would say, about 2 years before the actual liberation or revolution took place in 1949.
And within this framework that you've just described, the context, the backdrop for it all, your mother in this time period is still quite young, isn't she?
She was, well, starting with World War II, she was a little girl. I mean, World War II for China. In 1937, she was about 8 years old. And, you know, by the time the Communist Revolution happens and her family is deciding whether to stay or flee, like millions of other people in Shanghai are having a constant debate, should we stay, should we flee, that's a drawn-out process for her and her family. And so they decide to flee, and she is 19 or 20 years old at that time.
Isn't there a point at which her parents say, we just can't afford this child?
Yes, she was born into a, and this is part of the story that I had no idea about until, you know, many, many years later, and my mother was actually in her 70s already when she told me this, and but it was that her biological parents, her birth parents, had given her away when she was 6 years old. And that was quite a shocker. You know, this was the kind of thing, the secret, that my mother had never told me. And so when I say the family that she was with as a teenager and then getting ready to flee, this was an adoptive family. And so in a lot of societies, not just China, but, you know, at a time of war and world war, there were many, many children, many abandoned children, many orphaned children who were just wandering the streets and the countrysides. And people would, you know, quote, adopt them or basically take them in. And some of those people were very kind. I would say probably most of them were kind and generous, and some of them were not and were using these children for various, you know, sometimes terrible reasons. But my mother was fortunate. She found she was found by a family who took her in, and actually, not to give too much away, but she had she was abandoned twice, and so she was a child of war and a lot of trauma, and you know, abandonment for a little kid. And my mother had the most incredible memory, and as she was telling me this shocking story that just I had no idea about, at some point she paused for a breath, and I just mumbled something like, "Mom, your memory is so good." And she just said, "I was 6 years old. I remember everything. It was the worst day of my life." And in the course of this book, I ended up researching, finding many, many other people who had experienced all sorts of things during this war and occupation, and most of them had not experienced the abandonment that my mother did, but all of them had lived through a time of just tremendous trauma. I mean, seeing war, walking to school, or just being outside and being told, if you see a dead body on the street, walk the other way. And that was their childhood, a fear of running into enemy soldiers, a fear of being bayoneted or killed or raped or worse. And so most of the people I talked to had experienced just things that they had not even told their own children, like my mother had not told me. And after my book came out, and, you know, I would talk to people who had read it, and I can't tell you how many people have come up to me and said, "My parents never told me anything, and I'm hoping, how did you get your mother to tell you?" And maybe your book will help them open up about their experiences. And these are not just Chinese people either. It's, I think World War II was a period of really global global trauma. And when I think about the generations who experienced that, I think it would be safe to say that there was global PTSD, post-traumatic stress syndrome, that had never been really treated. And in that generation, it was just like, you know, swallow it and get over it.
Yeah.
Don't talk about it.
Yeah. Do you surmise, perchance, that there is a deficit of narratives that people have not compiled? And, you know, I don't – when I think about, say, World War II on the Western Front in Europe and the Allies, I just know of endless stories of the Greatest Generation and of refugees and such, people getting back on their feet. I get a sense that there's kind of – not enough that's been told of these who fled out of Shanghai and out of China.
Well, in fact, my book, which I wrote about because I couldn't find anything, any other information after I heard my mother's story, I was like, okay, what was her experience in the context of other people, of what was going on in China, around the world? And I can say authoritatively there is not a single book in the English language about this exodus, not just out of Shanghai. So maybe a million or so left Shanghai, but millions left China out of other ports. I could only manage the ones, you know, researching out of Shanghai.
When your mother finally started to speak about this, was it a dam that broke, or was it just that one night, and that's what you got that one night? Were you able to follow up and get more and more detail?
Oh, my. It was a dam that broke, and I have to say that it was just a coincidental thing. I was in my 50s. My mother was in her 70s. We were having dinner, and like any grown child, I'm thinking like, oh, what conversation can I make with my mother, and let's not talk about aches and pains tonight. And I just said, gee, Mom, too bad you can't tell me about your childhood. I mean, it wasn't like, tell me again. It was, oh, too bad. And at that point, we were eating. She put her chopsticks down, and she said, all right, you want to know, I'll tell you. And it was at that point I just gulped, and I just tried to say nothing that would stop her. And I had to ask her, what made you tell me this now? And she reflected on it, and she said, you know, she had a bunch of grandchildren, and two of the grandchildren were about the same age, two little granddaughters were about the same age she was when she was abandoned. And she said, maybe it's because I look at them, and she loves all of her grandchildren, and she said, and I think how lucky they are to have family that loves them. And I think for the people who talk to me, too, there's a period of time it takes to heal from trauma like war or things, terrible catastrophes you've witnessed and escaped from as children or young adults. And many times, you know, it takes decades before people are ready to talk about it. And I think I interviewed my mother when she was in her 70s. Many of the other people I talked to, the average age was 80, and they might not have told anybody the things they told me. And they were just ready at that time. And I think, you know, one piece of advice I would give to anybody who has family secrets, and I think that's pretty much everybody, don't give up. Keep asking. Because what happens if we stop asking is, I think, the conclusion is, well, nobody will really care, so why should I talk about this?
Helen Zia, author of Last Boat Out of Shanghai, the epic story of the Chinese who fled Mao's revolution. Some of the refugees who were on those last boats or airplanes out of Shanghai actually had arrived there only a generation earlier, also as refugees, in the first story coming by train, fleeing from the Russian Revolution through Siberia. Apparently, if you want to get out of town really fast or even just travel fast, you sometimes need a train or a plane or a car, maybe even just a wheel. If you go back far enough in time, the wheel has been around for a very long time indeed. But here's the surprise. The wheel did not immediately become popular, as you may have thought.
Well, originally, the Egyptians were not very impressed by wheels, but they managed to build the pyramids without using wheels at all. And they, in fact, didn't really adopt them for a couple of thousand years. And this is because the easiest way to move stuff around in Egypt was to use the River Nile and just float things on rafts and move things up and down the Nile that way. And the idea that wheels were sort of immediately seized upon as the greatest invention ever is a very modern idea. It's only in the early 20th century, when the world has been reshaped by wheeled vehicles, that you know, that the idea that the wheel is the greatest invention of all time becomes more widespread. So for the Egyptians, they are pretty much ignoring wheels. And then it's about sort of 1600 BC, I think, that the Hittites come up with these war chariots, which are small, light, two-wheeled vehicles that can go extremely fast. And they become extremely powerful militarily. They conquer a big chunk of the ancient Near East. And the Egyptians have to respond, so they start building chariots too, and they have this big chariot battle against the Hittites, the Battle of Kadesh.
The ever-changing story of humans in motion will occupy us after the news right here on Constant Wonder.